Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. How are we all doing? Good, good to see you all. I have to begin with an apology. I have to finish at a hard stop at the end today. I have to run somewhere afterwards, so I really apologize for ending on time. And I'm going to have to kind of speed out of here, so please don't take it personally. If you have something, feel free to give me a call. I'll be in the car. I can take calls on the phone. Feel free to send me an email. I'll respond at least within a decade. I'll get back to you. So feel free to do that. So Parsha, what's the Parsha this week? Excellent, on the sheet, Vayetze, which means, literally, and he went out, and he departed. Now, that is the pasuk that we'll put under pressure when we get back to looking at that. The opening pasuk of the Parsha, which picks up from last week. Yaakov flees under the threat of fratricide from his furious brother, and he begins his journey. Now, we'll do a survey of what happens in the Parsha. I'm happy to take comments, questions, and insights along the way. So, Yaakov flees. He suddenly, v'yifka b'makom, he arrives at this place. He lies down, puts his head on some stones, goes to sleep, and he has what is the first dream of Bereshit, of Genesis. The first dream in a series of dreams that will come in the Parsha to come. And what is his dream about? Excellent. So my question was ambiguously phrased. What it's about, the answer is nobody knows what it's about, but we know what happens in it, right? What happens in it? There's a ladder, there are angels going up and down. What is it about? I'm not sure. There are all sorts of rabbinic readings of this. In fact, the Malbim, of course, the most important figure in the history of Jewish life, is the subject of my dissertation. The Malbim says that actually the fact that this dream is so ambiguous, it's vivid, it's captured the imagination of artists for centuries, but it's ambiguous. And that's actually an indication of Yaakov's inferior prophetic capacity. Moshe doesn't have dreams. What does Moshe have? Conversations. He has conversations. There is one vision that he does have, which is the snare, the burning bush. It's a waking vision, not a dream, and it comes with a message. It's not just a sight, but actually the Malbim also says that's his inauguration, his initiation into prophecy, which begins with the imaginative faculties, not with instruction. So Yaakov has this dream. There is a ladder with angels. Now, having said it's ambiguous, we don't know what it means. What are we taught that it means? What is this dream about? Why is it a ladder? Why are angels going up and down? Any thoughts? Excellent. So as a Brit, the changing of the guard is very important. Anyone who's been to Buckingham Palace, this is the changing of the guard. There is a national guard and there is an international guard. Angelic entourage for Yaakov. He's on the brink of leaving the land of Israel. So there is a switch of angels. Now, while that solves one issue, which is what on earth is this dream about, it's actually also solving a textual issue. What textual issue is that midrash solving that suggests the angels are shifting, changing guards? If you were to have a dream about angels, where would you imagine they would begin their journey? From heaven, coming down and going up. But Sukkim described the angels going up and down, meaning the angels started on earth. What are they doing down here? Which generates that reading that actually the angels were with Yaakov and they're changing shift. They're changing God for his international entourage. Much like the Secret Service might have a local team and a domestic and a foreign team. So he has that dream. Why is a ladder so important? Why couldn't they climb a rope? Why can't they fly? What has a ladder got to do with anything? We've got a beautiful, thank you, Debbie, we have a show-and-tell item here with a ladder. There's Yaakov sleeping at the bottom on the stones. I notice how many stones is he sleeping on? I don't know, but it's more than one. And then we have, oh, he's sleeping at both ends. Oh, it depends how you turn it. Either way, why is a ladder important? In fact, anyone heard of William Blake? William Blake was a British, obviously, poet, painter. He wrote a number of very important poems that have captured people's attention. There's one called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. He did a number of illustrations to biblical texts. The Book of Job, he did illustrations. Paradise Lost, he did a number of illustrations. And actually, he's claimed, talking of Paradise Lost, he's part of the Romantic movement, William Blake. And he said, anyone ever read Paradise Lost? I think I've asked this before with the, anyone ever heard of Paradise Lost? Good. Excellent. So it's a vivid description of the fall of Satan from hell, into hell rather, and then the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. And a number of Romantic writers noticed that Milton seems to be very vivid, very descriptive when he's talking about hell and Satan and rebellion and fall and tragedy. And when he's describing the angelic retinue in heaven, when he's describing God, his language is quite plain. It's not that descriptive. It's very simple. And people have to contend with, why is he so vivid when it comes to hell and so plain when it comes to heaven? And there are a number of different readings. But the Romantics said, and Blake is the one who gave this phrase, he said, Milton was of Satan's party without knowing it. Meaning he had a joy for rebellion and instinct and impulse and hellish behavior, is his way of writing that. Now, William Blake has an image of this dream that he does, biblical illustrations, and he doesn't draw a ladder. He draws a winding staircase, which may trigger one's imagination in a very different way. Why is a ladder so important? It's almost a rickety structure. If you're getting up to heaven, you would imagine a staircase would be far more stable. Why do you want a ladder?
Rungs,
okay, interesting. So there is a suggestion, which doesn't necessarily differentiate it from a staircase, but certainly from like a beam, like beam me up. Scotty, is that what it is? Star Trek?
Yeah.
Because when you climb a ladder, wherever you're standing, nobody is above you and nobody is below you. There's always a direct fall or a direct aspiration. The suggestion being that in spiritual life, you shouldn't be looking down, you shouldn't be looking up. You shouldn't be intimidated by those above you and think, I can never reach there. And you should never feel satisfied that, oh, there are people below me, I'm fine. You always have to understand that you're on your own rung and there's more to do and you've come from somewhere. That's one suggestion. Another suggestion struck me a while ago, so it may not be a very good one, is that if you're on a staircase and it's cloudy and you're in the middle of the staircase, you've no idea where it ends. You've no idea that it ends anywhere. In fact, Tevye famously said, I want a staircase leading nowhere just for show. Ladders, if you're on a ladder and you can't see the end, just by its mechanics, you know that it ends somewhere because otherwise it would fall. It's leaning on something. There is a sense of faith, even in the dark, you have a sense of gravity, a sense of groundedness. There's also an interesting suggestion that actually this dream was a science lesson, a lecture to Yaakov on genetics. And the ladder, the sulam, is in fact a double helix. And this is a moment where he's been communicated the idea of genetics. What on earth has that got to do with anything? Later in the parsha, he's going to play around with the sheep and interbreed them in a way that leads to the population shifting. And there's a suggestion that he was given an indication of how the genetics works, and then he plays with the sheep in his dealing with Lavan to maneuver himself. Yeah.
I was thinking, similar to what you said before this, that if you can't see to the end of the ladder and you start ascending, you have to have a lot of faith that there's an end and it's leaning on something. So a ladder does symbolize a kind of a leap of faith. You don't go onto a ladder unless you know it's grounded both on top and bottom.
Right. So, and you don't know where it is, but you know it ends somewhere. So there is that faith, but it has a grounding. Right. Wonderful. There's a whole slew of commentators who suggest that sulam, ladder, is actually just a code. There was no ladder. Sulam has a gematria, which leads to 14 million other things. Sulam is also the gematria of Sinai, and this was actually a vision of revelation hundreds of years later. All sorts of computations that mean Sulam is something else entirely. Interesting. Now, he has this vision of angels going up and down, and we say he wakes up and he says, wow, I didn't realize it was holy here. Boy, I'm in trouble. And he sets up a matzevah, and he says, I'm off. And he goes to the distant land where he is going for two purposes. Why is he going back to his ancestral land, to Haran?
For
to find a wife and to save his life, right? So he's fleeing threats and he's trying to find a wife. He arrives at the scene. There are sheep grazing in the field. There are three flocks by this well. He gets to the well. There's an enormous stone that ordinarily it would take 10 men to lift up. Why would you want a stone that it takes 10 men to lift up if you're thirsty? I wouldn't want to have a water cooler that involves 14 fingerprints for me to get a drink. Why would they put a stone that heavy on? To make sure that nobody is sneaking it, that I don't come in the middle of the day and start emptying the water cooler into my big bucket. But actually, it's a limited resource that needs to be shared. And Yaakov demonstrates extraordinary, superhuman strength. He lifts it up with his own two hands. He sees his to-be wife, somebody he falls in love with, Rachel. And what's the first thing that he does? Gives her a kiss. Romantic, beautiful, and problematic. Why is it problematic? Right. By today's standards, by halachic standards, it seems to be problematic. And in fact, when I was in yeshiva, somebody secondhand told me that once this question was posed to Rav Lichtenstein or Vamital, we always talk, we go to camp every summer, and it's all that the Madrachim want to talk to us about. Shomenegir, you've got to be Shomenegir, you've got to be Shomenegir. They only want to talk to us about it because that's all we want to talk about. But Yaakov, first thing he does, he sees Rachel and he gives her a kiss. Remind me what I'm in the middle of saying, so I'm about to take a digression. Somebody pointed out to me that the Torah obviously has humor as well, double entendre. How are we told that Rachel is coming? How do you say in Hebrew, and Rachel came? V'Rachel ba'a. What does Rachel mean in Hebrew? V'Rachel ba'a. There you go. Yeah. I'm going to assume that wasn't the intention because that's a pretty low bar of humor. But I was in the middle of something else, right? So he was asked, Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Amital was asked, how could Yaakov kiss Rachel on first meeting? And his answer was, what happens in the next moment in the text? He cries. The very, it says he kissed he kissed Rachel and then he cried. Of Yisak all over. He lifted up his voice and he cried. So obviously he realized he made a mistake. So that was that's a pretty quick, perhaps unconvincing answer. I see in the look on some of your faces that you're not convinced by that answer. And actually, Rav Moshe Tarragon, who's a teacher at Gush, the yeshiva I went to, had I listened to, it was 40 minutes on this question. I did listen to it on speed 1.5, which I'm told people do to this, which is very helpful. But he said that he was once with young students who were interviewing for the yeshiva, and one of them was trying to catch him out and said, how could Yaakov have kissed Rachel? And he went on to give a detailed explanation of how he felt that standards can shift over time and things change. And he didn't quite make this link, but it's almost lahavdil, the equivalent of saying, how could Jefferson own slaves? He wrote documents about freedom, liberty, emancipation, the idea of equal human rights. He's living in a state of contradiction. How could he own slaves? And what is one way to address that question? I'm not suggesting it will resolve all the ethical issues, but what's one answer to that? Culture was different. Culture was different. He didn't live in a state of ethical contradiction because the culture didn't see him in that light. And we have to always look back on history, that culture shift, what is appropriate shift, what's considered ethical, shifts, evolves, moves with the culture, which is something that we in our age, and I say we generically and broadly, find very difficult to contemplate, that there is a possibility that the figures of the past weren't horrific because they don't match the standards of our contemporary perfection. When we want to rip down statues, and I'm not getting into the Civil War right now, just generally, there are organizations that have, for example, you go to London, you go to Houses of Parliament, there's a statue of Richard III right outside the Houses of Parliament, famous king, Richard the Lionheart has a prominent role in The Prince of Thieves, the movie, Robin Hood, with Kevin Costner right at the end, Sean Connery, for some reason Richard the Lionheart is Scottish, but you can't have everything, and he's out there on his horse looking very impressive. What else did he launch other than Robin Hood's film career? The Crusades. And standing there as a Jew, you feel like, okay, well, maybe we should get rid of him. But there are historical circumstances that mean that he didn't necessarily view himself as horrific and evil, I think we could all agree that there are figures in the 20th century who performed acts that we can consider horrific and evil by objective standards, and that people of the time knew that this was horrific, abhorrent, and unworthy. But to suggest that, because the standards of halachic life that have come since Sinai evolved over time with rabbinic borders and boundaries, it's quite possible Yaakov kissed his cousin in the most innocent and pure of ways. So that's one question. He kissed her, and then he cries. And the question, of course, is why he cries at that moment, if it's not just because, oi, show me a gear, I shouldn't have done that. Why is he crying? There are a number of fascinating readings as to why he cries that we can get to in the coming years. Maybe over Shabbat I'll talk about it. Who knows? He lifts a stone, he gives her a kiss, and then he meets these two sisters, Rachel and Leah. How are they described? One is described as beautiful of form, beautiful of appearance. And the other is described as having a naim rachot, soft eyes. I don't, weak maybe, soft eyes. Now, what is that description getting at? I know that we've been asked in the past, why is there such a focus on aesthetics in the biblical text? Often you're introduced to a figure, and one way of attributing them greatness is to say they were beautiful. You have Rachel described as beautiful of form, beautiful of appearance. Who else in Bereshit is going to be described as beautiful? So Sarah is described not objectively, but by her husband as beautiful. Same with Rivka. Yosef is described objectively by the text, much as Rachel is, as being yafeh, as being beautiful. Avigail, one of David's wives, is described at the time as being beautiful and intelligent. There is a beauty that is attached to these figures. Why is that important? I don't have an exceptional answer for you, other than perhaps they were attractive and beautiful, and however much we want to transcend that as a factor in human life, it is impossible to ignore that physical beauty is part of what drives human beings. It's part of what drives people's attention. It's part of what drives publicity. Celebrity is driven by this. Sales departments are driven by this. In advertising campaigns, if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it. And we'd like to ignore it, but physical beauty can add a dynamic into a relationship that makes it complicated. In fact, Yosef, we'll get to him in the parasha, but he's critiqued for self-beautifying, for attending to his hair, for focusing on his looks, and perhaps leading to a sense of narcissism that led to his downfall among his brothers. So beauty is a factor in the scene. It may not be a point of praise that they're beautiful, but just a description to help us understand the dynamics on the ground at the time. What about soft eyes? What does that mean? You had something else?
I wanted to think, just I was listening to Shir about the parallels between this narrative and Yaakov and Esav narrative. And one parallel is that Yaakov and Esav are both described at birth with descriptions. So Rachel and Leah are also given descriptions. I mean, there are a lot of other parallels, that Vayisat, Kolo Vaye is parallel to Esav crying out after he realizes that he missed out on the bracha. So there are a lot of parallels in these narratives, but one of them that I don't remember who pointed this out, but that was pointed out, but this is a description of two twins, that they're twins, that Rachel and Leah are supposedly twins. This is Yaakov and Esav, where we have the whole, we don't do this here, we don't give the younger before, we give the older, and that's one of the parallels, that they're described, just like Yaakov and Esav are also described. One is ruddy and one is, you know,
smooth, right?
Or each time, there are differences between the two.
So very interesting.
This is pointed out between Rachel and Leah, as they were pointed out between Yaakov and Esau.
Very interesting. We're given a vivid impression of these figures to bring them to life. These two twins, Yaakov and Esav on the one hand, Rachel and Leah on the other, which leads precisely to one of the readings of what it means that she had soft eyes. Just on its surface, what does that mean? One is being described as beautiful of form and appearance, the other is described as having soft eyes. What just on its surface do you think that might mean? What is it trying to say? Oh, great. So we've got a few different possibilities on the surface. My instinct would be, if it's setting up a contrast, saying she's beautiful, It's a kind of a kind way to say that she was, well, what's the polite word? Homely? Homely, right? In the Old Scroll translations, you get that often. That she had soft eyes, meaning, I don't know why that would mean homely, but that's the instinct is that there's a contrast. The description is strange, and soft eyes, somebody mentioned that she cried a lot, and that's the way, actually, that Rashi and others suggest that she had soft eyes, meaning her eyes had been worn by tears. Why was she crying so much? Because her sister, you go on.
Well, the party line was that she was crying because she thought she was going to be going to marry Esau. You know, that's what they tell you.
That's
you
the party line, meaning that's the line that Rashi draws based on a midrash, right? That she used to cry a lot. Why was she crying a lot? Precisely for the contrast that you've mentioned, the parallel that you mentioned, that she presumed that she was the older, she would marry Esav, and the younger Rachel would marry Yaakov. And actually, the description of her eyes has nothing to do with her physical beauty. We're just describing her younger sister as beautiful, and she had soft eyes. And actually, maybe beauty in that context, if you see that as a contrast, is not about aesthetics, but it is about innocence. She is aware of something looming, and she's crying. She has soft eyes, and her younger sibling is just beautiful of appearance. I mean, sometimes you go into a room and you're not thinking about aesthetics, not thinking about physical attraction. There's just somebody who glows, somebody who fills the room with a light and an energy. And it's beautiful because there's a vitality to them. And Rachel walks into the room with no cares in the world. She was beautiful of appearance. She was beautiful of form. And it's just suggesting she lives in a state of joy, innocence, and purity. But her older sister had soft eyes. She never had that freedom. She faced a world where there was a looming threat that she would marry this figure that she knows has grown up to be horrific. I saw, actually, just minutes before I came down to give the shiur, a friend of mine posted on Facebook an observation about this. This is why the internet is so powerful, and Facebook is great. He said, how did she know? Why is she crying over this? Who said that she had to marry Esau? And he said, actually, if you look in Rashi, the text does give a suggestion. It says she cried a lot because her kol omrim, everybody said that this is what was going to happen. And his observation is, everybody said it, and you've got to believe it. That's the power of rumor to define our destiny. That's the power of perception to define who we are, and we can throw that off. We don't have to be bound by what everybody says. In fact, I don't want to, again, dive into politics, but that's all that's in the news. But yesterday, some of you may have seen there were videos going around of other people talking about other people. Anybody know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Right, there was a group of world leaders that were caught on tape. Why they didn't think they were being videoed is beyond me. You have to live your life assuming that everybody is videoing you all the time. And if you're a public leader, you should think that all the time you're being videoed. But they were caught, I wouldn't say bad-mouthing, but maybe mocking or making fun or making light of the American president. And we all know how thick his skin is, and he took it quite well. No, he did not take it well. And you could see he was agitated when he was asked, and he almost instinctively shouted out against him. And then instinctively also thought, oh, that's going to be headline news. I shouldn't know. All right. He's a nice guy. He's a nice guy. Whereas a politician who had been trained in the art of politics from youth would have said, everybody's entitled to private conversations. And then quietly on the phone, he would have said, you're two-faced, don't do that to me. but either way, the suggestion is, I call Omrim, everybody says it. So let everybody say it. What do I get? Everybody says it. I'll survive. I'll be fine. So that's the continuation of that scene. We then have the two sisters. There is Yaakov agrees to work. This is the first time that we're told of someone falling in love and then wanting their hand in marriage, not just set up, not just arranged, not just they happen to be married, but he, v'yahev, he loved her and he pursued her. This was a romantic pursuit and he's willing to work for her hand. There is, of course, then the trick where she switches places with her sister, wakes up in the morning, says, oh, you're not who I thought I married. That's a mistake, which is why we all use veils at weddings to reenact that moment. And there is a midrash that, again, I don't want to delve too deeply into, but I'll just throw out there, that says at one moment, Yaakov wakes up in the morning, turns to Leah and says, how could you deceive me? How could you do this to me? And her response, I learn from the best. Last week you deceived your father, this week I deceive you. Don't tell me off for something that you've done. Which is an incredibly harsh critique, which tells you that actually Chazal, the sages, are quite open to exploring the psychological dynamics of these relationships. And then Yaakov may be projecting, has some guilt for what he's done. And he doesn't complain, right? He doesn't overturn this. He doesn't go to his father-in-law and say, this is invalid. So that midrash is actually not necessarily portraying a conversation that happened, but exhibiting the psyche of Yaakov. He doesn't complain, he doesn't move on, he doesn't throw up in the air. He says, I'll keep this. Why? Why does he tolerate the circumstance? And Chazal is suggesting that projecting into his psyche, there is a latent guilt. That maybe this was coming to me. Maybe I've deceived, maybe I was deserving of being deceived. So that's the marriage. He then works for another 7 years, marries Rachel eventually. We have the birth of the tribes at this point, the children being born. He then escapes with his wife. And then we have a very harsh description, V'tignav Rachel, and Rachel stole. In fact, the translations, the Aramaic translation, the Targumim, don't write stole, but took, saved, removed. They try to avoid the force of that, the ethical negativity of the word that she stole these things. These terafim, these idols from her father, and they run away. Lavan wakes up, realizes what's going on, and he pursues them. They then make this covenant at the Gal Eid, the Gal Sa'aduta, the heap of testimony. And then after that, they separate, and Yaakov is standing. You imagine as the credits start to roll, you hear the music at the end of the parasha winding in. He looks into the distance, and what does he see? Anyone know the last two psukim? He sees a band of angels, machanayim, camps of angels, which the Malbim also happens to point out, machanayim is in plural, because there are two camps of angels, which is an insinuation to him. When do you have camps generally, not just in the summer for kids, when do you have camps, encampments? War. When do you have two encampments? When you're fighting each other. This was a looming insinuation. War is on the horizon, which of course next week's parasha is his confrontation with this figure and Esav in midnight. So he's already being aware that there's war approaching. Then he hears the marching of 400 men and he starts to get worried. Now, what are the parentheses of this parasha? Two visions. And what are in those visions?
Angels.
And I remember this was not secondhand, but I was sitting there firsthand at Suda Shlishit in Gush. I guess it must have been 12 years ago or something. I was sitting at the table where Rav Lichtenstein was sitting and eating, and he gave a talk over Suda Shlishit. And I had a friend of mine. Again, in England, there aren't that many Jewish religious secondary schools. And so the Hashkafic background of the students is relatively broad. I say relatively broad because we're all observant Jews who do mitzvot and believe in God, so it can't be that broad. You know, wears a different colored hat, wears a different colored jacket, but relatively broad. And a friend of mine who had been to a yeshiva who was a little more right-wing was staying with me for Shabbos, and we were listening, and Rav Lichtenstein gave his talk, and the bottom line, the bullet point of the talk was, Yaakov begins this parasha seeing angels. He then undergoes a diasporic, exilic trauma where he is forced to negotiate with a hostile father-in-law, where he's tricked, he's deceived, he's working with sheep, he's dealing with muck and grime and farming. This is all sanitized in the textual narrative, but he's getting his hands dirty all day. He's dealing with sheep and birth and fluid and all sorts of stuff. And then what's at the end? He's seeing angels. And the suggestion here is that we need to engage with the world, we need to engage with our lives and still be able to see angels. And my friend said, oh, this is very gushy. This is very gushy, this idea that you should be involved with the world, that you should try to deal with life and then still be capable of seeing angels. And I said, yep, welcome. So that's the parasha overview. We have 10 minutes left. So on the sheet that you have, we're going to go right back to the beginning, and I'm going to ask you the question that we ask when we put our pasuk under pressure. As we're reading this, you don't have to shout it out, but you're welcome to. I want you to think about the following things worthy of note. Ambiguity. Words that don't give enough clarity. repetition, things that we don't need. So places where you need more information, places where we could do with less information. Let's think about that. V'yetze Yaakov mi'Be'er Sheva, and Jacob departed from Be'er Sheva, v'yelech Charana, and he went to Charan. Pasuk 1. Everything good? Everybody happy? Nothing that we don't need? Nothing that we would need? Everything good? All right, everybody happy? That's unbelievable. Okay. I'll give you a clue. Rashi is not happy. A whole number of commentators aren't happy. What don't we necessarily need here? What could you take out of that pasuk? Yeah. You could take out 2/3 of this pasuk and it wouldn't damage the flow of narrative. You just say, Ve'yelech Yaakov Charana. Yaakov went to Charan. How do we know that he came from Be'er Sheva? Because last week's parsha said that's where he was. Obviously he came from. Why do you need to tell us where he's come from? Just say, Ve'yelech Yaakov Charana. Well, what do you have to say? Ve'yetze Yaakov Be'er Sheva. He left Be'er Sheva and he went somewhere else. Which some of you may be familiar, Rashi says, that actually departing a place has an impact too. This isn't just, when you leave, you don't just go somewhere, you leave somewhere behind, and you have to be cognizant of that as well. And this gets translated into the rabbinic moralization, that actually when you're in a place, you make an impression, you have an imprint. When you're in a place, your presence has an impact. And when you leave, there is a vacuum. And you should be conscious of that when you leave a place, and we should all be conscious of that when other people leave a place. For Yetzi Yaakov and Be'er Sheva, he left Be'er Sheva, Yelech Charanan, he went to Charan. There's also a point here. V'yetze Yaakov mi'Be'er Sheva, it should then say, Lalechet Charana, not Vayelech, and he went. This is not two distinct movements. This is one act. He left and he went. He left to go to Charan. And actually, when Avram is given the call, Lech Lecha, then when he departs, it says, Lalechet Arza Kanan. He goes to go to. So why is there two verbs for this single act? Which is also that textual problem is what leads or what triggers that midrash that suggests actually these are two trips. And right in the middle of this is condensed a period of time where he stayed somewhere else. Yetzi Yaakov mi'Be'er Sheva, he left Be'er Sheva. V'yelech Charan, he went to Charan, is a separate trip. There's a gap in the middle where he did what? Where he was in the yeshiva and Shem Ve'eva, right? And these midrashim strike us as what I've been talking about on Shabbat afternoon, where the rationalists of the 18th and 19th century, the biblical scholars, said, these rabbis are nuts. They're crazy. They're coming up with, like, what it just says that he went to Haran. They say, oh, he spent 14 years in Shem Ve'eva. He never slept. He never did anything. Where are they coming up with this stuff? And the answer, to some degree, is they're looking very attentively at the words of the text, and they value each letter, each inflection, as being of worth. And the suggestion here that there are two verbs for a single act is enough to warrant an exegetical narrative, that there's a suggestion that something happened here. And again, this isn't about archaeology. This isn't about getting what happened historically, why, what's the story embedded here, but there's a lesson that we're being invited to explore through a narrative that is being provoked by a textual, what we would call, gap. Although it's obviously not a gap, there's not a hole, but there is an opening for us to jump into. And then obviously once you open that hole and you start talking about he spent 14 years in another place, you have what's called pilpul. You have all these rabbinic discussions. Why did he need to spend 14 years in Shem Ve'eva? He's coming from the house of his father Yitzchak. What's a better place to learn? He has to go to Shem Ve'eva. And then you have discussions about, well, Yitzchak lived a pure life in the house of Avram. He just lived a life of innocence. Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. Yaakov is about to enter the real world. He's about to enter negotiations with Lavan. This isn't yeshiva time anymore. So he needed to go to a place of Shem Ve'eva. What did Shem Ve'eva live through? The flood. They lived through trauma, loss, despair, crime, depravity, breakdown, violence. They were people who understood how the world works, and he needed training to get from Ishtam to someone who can negotiate with Lavan and live a life in the outside world. And again, all of this is just an outgrowth of the fact that there's an extra verb in this pasuk. And while it may seem fantastical, when it's actually seen as dealing with a textual issue that invites us to have this conversation, it seems a little more compelling than just, oh, the rabbis are trying to make this fun for kids, but actually they're making the text come to life in a way that generates moral purchase on us. Okay, so it goes to Charan. V'yifka b'makom, v'yalen sham. And vayifka, what does vayifka mean? So vayinaga would be to touch. Vayifka, I'm trying to think, in modern Hebrew, pigua, it's like a meeting or an encounter. He encountered the place. He didn't just reach there, but vayifka, it's almost like he bumped into it. He kind of tripped. We have the same term right at the end. Excellent. That he bumps into the, he's a stumbler, Yaakov, and quite literally, next week's parasha, he's going to get a limp. So he seems to be unsteady on his feet to some degree. I may have run too far with that poetic image. He bumped into the place and he dwelt there. Now, any ambiguity here that we need to resolve? Everything good? Any word here that you would say, I need a bit more information? Makom. He arrived at the place. Wonderful. If my GPS said, go to the place, turn left at the place and go right. I don't know what the place is. What is Makom? And we're going to see the word Makom appears three times in this and the next verse. He bumped into the place. He slept there because the sun, Kiva HaShemesh, the sun came. What does that mean, the sun came? The sunset is a way of speaking, but the terminology also incites the rabbis to suggest this was at an unnatural speed. The sun set quickly. The sun, there's a verb here. He came. V'yikach me'avnei ha-makom, he took from the stones of the place. What does that imply? How many? So it sounds like more than one. Me'avnei ha-makom, he took stones of the place. Could you read that in the singular, that he took one? How? Excellent. There you go. There's the rabbinic debate. He took from the stones, meaning there were many, and he took from them one stone. But when he wakes up, we're not going to get to this. When he wakes up, it says Evan. There was one stone, which is, again, what generates that rabbinic idea that he lay down on 12 and they all merged together overnight into one stone. It's not just a pretty thought to kids, but it's based on a textual issue that here it says he took from the stones and he wakes up on a stone. How do you account for that? Again, the simple grammatical answer is he just took one stone. He took me'avnei ha-makom. But there is an opening in the text to let us play with these ideas. Yeah.
In other places where the term ha-makom is used, like with Abraham, it's very, it's not very clear, but the term is used in, we're told that it means Har Moriah. Now, geographically, that obviously is not here, and yet we're using the same term. And repeatedly, it refers to Har Moriah.
The place, the definite article. I think that's also what leads Chazal to suggest that we know exactly where this is. This is on Temple Mount. This is Har Moriah. How do I know? There is that verbal linkage to Hamakom, the place. V'yasem roshotav, he put these stones. Murashotav, again, is ambiguous. It might mean around his head. It might mean beneath his head, which are radically different motivations. Why would you put a stone beneath your head?
To sleep.
To sleep. It's not that comfortable, but I guess it's better than just breaking your neck. Why would you put it around your head if you want a pillow? You put it around your head like a little helmet to keep the wildlife away. Those are very different psyches. That's one is a person who's looking to relax, and one is a person who can't relax and is actually terrified. And in the box underneath, we're not going to get to read it, but you're welcome to do it on your own. There are different ways to account for what this stone is doing. What is he motivated by here psychologically? And one view is he is just looking to get some comfort. He wants to be comfortable. He needs a pillow. And the other is that he's terrified about wildlife, what's lying out on the horizon, and he surrounds his head with a fence of stones. There's also a view in the Maharil that actually this is the source for a practice of mourning, to put a stone under your pillow, which some have the custom to do on Tisha B'Av, some have come to do other times, and that's because he's on Har Moriah and he had this premonition that there would be a loss on this spot in the Jewish future, which would be the destruction of the temple. So actually he was in a state of grief, of mourning, and he wanted to actually not have comfort but discomfort, and put a stone under his head. That's that first box. V'yishkav b'makom ahu, and he lay down in that place. Now, the bottom of the page, which we have minus 30 seconds to talk about, is a redundancy, which is worth spending an hour on itself. V'yikach me'avnei ha-makom, and he took from the stones of the place. If it would not have said v'yikach me'avnei ha'makom, it just said v'yikach avanim, v'yikach evan, would I need more information? Where would I think he's getting stones from? Presumably he didn't have UPS, he didn't have Amazon. If he wants stones, where's he going to get them from? The place. He took from the stones of the... Obviously he took from the stones of the place. What else is he going to be taking stones from? So what is Hamakom doing? He took from the stones of Hamakom of the place. Now, at the bottom of the page, we have a couple of suggestions. The Sforno says, actually, he took from the stones of the place. That indicates that this was not a barren hilltop. This was a place that had stones set up. When you go out to the middle of the park, or you go to one of the what are they called, national parks? Or you go out for a walk, you go to Cunningham Park. There are areas there which are just grass, but then there are areas where there are chairs set up and tables set up for people to be. And the Sforno suggests that this was a place where people would come to eat and lodge and sleep, and there were stone beds, stone tables, stone chairs. He's talking about Avnei HaMakom. Stones were there. This was not an uninhabited place. Which again, what does that tell us? It's an interesting detail to fill in for this 4-0. It gives a little bit more context to the picture that we have in our mind. But there's a suggestion again. Yaakov has never left home before. He may be in a state like Lot's daughters who think, there's nothing outside my house. And now he gets a suggestion, there's civilization. There are other people. I can live in this world. That's maybe one thing. The Chizkuni, the Imre Emet, has, there's all sorts of interesting Chassidic readings of this portion, where actually v'yikach avnei hamakom, what's hamakom? The place. But what else can hamakom mean? God. Where else do we say hamakom means God? When we go to Shiva, hamakom yinachem. We don't mean the place, although there are ways to read that as saying this place should bring you comfort. But we're talking about God. When else do we gather around a table and sing? Baruch Hamakom, Baruch Hu. Saying, blessed is the place. Maybe the place, but also talking about God as the origin of space. Avnei Hamakom, Chassidim read this as the building blocks of God, which is suggested to be language. He takes the letters of language. V'yasem Roshotav, and he puts language at the forefront, and he's actually composing a prayer, which is why this is the moment that is seen as the origin of Maariv, of the evening prayer. But that's a Hasidic reading. But the Chizkuni strikes me, and I'm going to be in a lot of trouble because I'm going to be late to the thing I have to run to, but I'm going to run. The Chizkuni says, Avnei HaMakom, the stones that were in this place, he goes further than the Sforno. They were here already, but they weren't just, this wasn't just a public picnic spot. What happened on this space with stones in our narrative already? The Akedah. The stones that he put his head down as a pillow were the stones that his father had been bound on as a sacrifice. And not wanting to, what's it called, flog a dead horse. But last Shabbat, the drasha I spoke about, the luxuries, the ease that we have in life is often a product of sacrifice that others have made for us in the past. And there is no more vivid expression of that idea than the possibility that Yaakov's pillow is the rock on which his father was nearly killed. That his comforts, that which gives him comfort in the wilderness when he's at loss, is the spot where his father was willing to give his life for the sake of God. And I think that's a profound thought. There's more to say, obviously, but we're out of time. So I'm going to wish you all a wonderful Shabbos. And again, forgive me for running out. I wish you all well.